Once he understood that myth could actually teach you something about truth, he was able to see that Christ was the true myth.
This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, the producer and the creator of the show. All About Jack is celebrating its 10th anniversary in 2021. Today is the fifth part of a six-part series focusing on the book The Fawn's Bookshelf. C.S. Lewis on Why Myth Matters. The author, Dr. Charlie Starr, will join us shortly to answer questions about it. Helping me with this task is the co-host for this mini-series, Dr. Sarah Waters. In fact, Sarah is going to take it from here.
As mentioned, this is the fifth episode of the series on The Fawn's Bookshelf, a book by Dr. Charlie Starr, who I'll welcome in a moment. In the last episode, we had Charlie provide an overview to both the third and the fourth part of his book, and there's a link in the show notes to that. Now, today we're going to go into greater detail with the third part, and that section is called Terror and Reality as Myth in Narnia. Now, before William starts us off with the first question, let's welcome Charlie back to All About Jack.
Hey, thanks. A 10th anniversary. That made me want to do some counting, William. I'd take it. What are we looking at? Easily over 100 episodes. Are you looking at around 200 even?
Yeah, probably so. If one were to look at my website where the podcast is hosted, it counts when I do a re-released or repost as if it was a new one. So it looks like I have over 1,000. And I have yet to go back through to do an exact count, but it's probably definitely over 200 episodes because of all the different special series I did in addition and such. So, yep, quite a few there.
You've had the chance to interview just about everybody in the Lewis world, including Walter Hooper and Douglas Gresham, but also many of the people who spent years and years studying C.S. Lewis. So it's a great resource. I hope people will continue to listen to All About Jack.
Well, thank you for your kind words, Charlie. And then, of course, I've been doing primarily focusing on interviewing book authors and then occasionally doing what we're doing here today, and that is a mini-series on a particular book. And you begin this third part with a chapter entitled Defining Myth. But as you noted in the first podcast, you don't actually provide a definition. Instead, you trace Lewis's quest to find where myth came from. Some of the influences are Barfield, Tolkien, and Dyson, if I recall correctly from your book. So give us a taste of what details you provide in your book, as well as maybe some reflections you've done since then.
Yeah, one of the reasons to approach Lewis's definition of myth biographically is because his definition of myth changed. Early in his life, he thought myth was what a lot of people think about myth, which was it's mere mythology. It has no truth value and it has no connection to reality whatsoever. You can enjoy it as literature, but otherwise it's really pretty purposeless. When he came to appreciate myth more, as he came to believe in the existence of supernatural things in the universe, he got to a point where he thought myth was still useless as far as truth knowledge was concerned. He referred to it as lies, though breathed through silver. So he didn't see any truth value in myth until a significant conversation in 1931 with J.R.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson. Prior to that, Lewis had loved myth. It had helped him encounter what he called joy, a kind of transcendent longing that nothing on earth could find satisfaction for. Myth would just arouse the desire, satisfy the desire. In 1928, he wrote some fragments in the back of a notebook, one of which he tried to figure out where myth came from. And at that time, he said, "We just don't know." And then it was a few years later that in the conversation with Tolkien and Dyson, so what Lewis learned from Tolkien is that myth is invention about reality. God is a creator, and he made us in his image, so we are creators. And when we make stories and when we name things, even the things in God's reality, like a tree or the stars, we are doing the act of invention. We are being sub-creators. And since these inventions are about reality, they can tell us truth about reality. And that was a key moment in Lewis's understanding. Once he understood that myth could actually teach you something about truth, he was able to see that Christ was the true myth. See, up to that point, Lewis had been a believer in God for over a year, what we would call a theist. But he had not yet become a Christian because he didn't understand what the death and resurrection of Christ meant. You can't believe in something that you don't understand the meaning of. And Tolkien said to Lewis, well, that's because you're trying to think about it philosophically and intellectually. And Tolkien said, anytime you encounter the myth of a dying and reviving God, you absolutely love it. But when you encounter it in the Gospels, you don't. That's because you're not prepared to receive it as a myth. Well, when Lewis understood then that myth could be connected to reality and that Christ could be the myth that was also historical, that was the final nail in his previous atheistic coffin. That is, that was the moment he went from having been an atheist to becoming a theist to finally becoming a Christian. And so that helped him understand that myth is invention about reality that nevertheless can connect us to real knowledge, to truth about reality. Although he wouldn't necessarily say myth connects us to truth as much as he would say it connects us to the real. And I do talk about that in places in the book. Now, one of the things about the chapter on defining myth that I regret is something that happens in Lewis studies all the time, and that is, as soon as you're done writing the book and it's in the publisher's hands and they're just about to publish it, you find those couple of Lewis quotes that you desperately wish you had known about so that you could then use them in the book. So I do define myth in the book in the sense that I quote from Lewis in Experiment and Criticism, where he lists six qualities of myth in terms of how they have an impact on a reader. All right, so he explains myth from the point of view of literature, and you can find that then on page 86 in the Fawn's bookshelf, although that's in a later chapter than the one we're talking about right now. But then also you can find some definitions of myth in various other places in Lewis. And let me toss a couple of those out for those who are reading through my book right now or who have read it in the past. One of these is to be found in Walter Hooper's book, Past Watchful Dragons. And he quotes from a notebook in which Lewis defines myth. He says, a myth is the description of a state, an event, or a series of events involving superhuman personages possessing unity, not truly implying a particular time or place, and dependent for its contents not on motives developed in the course of action, but on the immutable relations of the personages. But the one I really like is one that I found in one of Lewis's letters. This is in his collected letters, and I apologize for not noting which volume I got it out of. I believe I got it out of volume 2. Of Lewis's collected letters, and it's on page 438. And here he defines myth in this way. He says, what has a meaning is the total story, and the separate characters or properties are mere products of analysis, i.e. rescuing Eurydice from hell and losing her by looking back has a meaning that neither Eurydice or Eurydice in isolation nor hell in isolation has. Or if it has, you get it by analysis out of the total meaning and don't build up the total meaning out of them. Also, in a symbolical narrative, the meaning usually cannot be stated in conceptual terms. It lives only in the story. And that is a very key idea for Lewis. The closest he gets to defining myth as myth is a literary definition. He talks about how myth means, and myth means in very different ways than other types of literature or normal discourse. And he talks about the kinds of effect myth has on a particular reader.
Great, thank you very much. Now, you write really interestingly about monks and a few other words as well, from another of the titles found on Tumnus's bookshelf. And I was wondering if you might be able to elaborate on them a bit for us.
Yes. So one of the books on Tumnus's bookshelves is Men, Monks, and Gamekeepers, A Study in Popular Legend. And this may be the title that most intrigued me and turned me toward writing the book at all, because I can understand why gamekeepers would be a myth in Narnia, because in Narnia, there aren't any, the animals talk, so they don't need to be any gamekeepers. And men can be a myth because they've been excluded from Narnia for at least 100 years since the White Witch took over. But then more interestingly, monks. Why would Lewis pick monks? And there's some alliteration going on there. Men, monks, and gamekeepers. And Lewis loved alliteration, but I don't think it's just that. But he could have picked something like airplanes, right? But he picked monks instead. And so I really had to think about that. Why monks? And what occurred to me is that monks would be mythic to the Narnians, because the Narnians don't have any kind of organized religion. The animals don't have priests of any kind. I think maybe the centaurs come closest, but I think they tend to be more like prophets. But they don't have protist nymphs. They don't have badgertists. They don't have satyro-orthodox. There is no mother hen church to be found in Narnia. And so I think for the Narnia, and I guess that's because they have Aslan. Even though Aslan might have been gone for a very long time, the animals have good memories, especially the badgers, we learn in Prince Caspian. So no organized religion, therefore no priests. Whatever the reason is the case for that, the Narnians then would be absolutely fascinated by the existence of beings, men or whatever, who so utterly and completely devote their lives to the great emperor across the sea through both a lifestyle and ritual. And then we can add things like thought and service, that these would have been wonderful characters. I think the closest thing we might glean today is when we look back on the love of saints that especially medieval Christians had. These great servants of the church who were great heroes, great inspirations. Well, I think then the idea of monks would have been an inspiration to the Narnians. And that's why Lewis mentions them here in Tumnus's bookshelf.
Well, now, also in your eighth chapter, you explore how myth and allegory are often confused. You also indicate how C.S. Lewis helps us distinguish between the two. So how does he, and how do you describe it in your book?
A simple way to think about the difference between myth and allegory is to say a myth means, an allegory is a particular meaning that we draw out of myth. So for Lewis, following the quote that I just read, the whole myth is itself a meaning. All the elements as they work together. The individual parts, we might try to assign some specific symbolism to them. And so we will say that Aslan is Christ and the White Witch is Satan and Edmund is Judas. And as we make all of these applications, symbolic one-for-one applications, we are removing the mythic meaning to a realm of something that's more conscious, but less mythic, and that is the realm of allegory. Lewis says in one of his letters, an allegory is something into which the author puts exactly what he intends in terms of the meaning. So in a great allegory like Pilgrim's Progress, each character, each town, all of these things have very specific meanings. But in a myth, the author will put not only the meaning that he intends, but more meaning than he is even aware of. One difference between myth and allegory then is that myth is sort of a kind of semi-conscious activity, born up out of the collective unconscious, if we go with Carl Jung. It is part of this web of thought that Lewis talks about in Paralandra, the interconnectedness of all minds, and then suggests again that idea of God being able to reach down even to the pagan poets and reach in through their imaginations in order to speak truth to them, but not propositional truth, instead some sort of imagistic reality. Again, Lewis preferred the word reality, I think, there to the word truth. So allegory is far more intentional than myth. Allegory is far more conscious than myth. But allegory's meanings are far more limited than myth. Allegory's meanings are very specific, and mythic meaning is much more intertextual, interconnectual, to coin a new word there. Anytime you begin to say, well, here's what the myth means, you are taking this concrete thing, or this thing that's meant to be experienced concretely, this thing called myth, and you are abstracting meanings, not meaning, but meanings, plural, out of it, tiny little isolated meanings. And those meanings then are a kind of allegorical reading of myth. Now, Lewis would say that's perfectly fine. You can do that if you want to. But if you do that, you are not taking in the myth as myth. You are not experiencing the myth. You are thinking about the myth. You are analyzing the myth, if you will. One way to think about it might be the difference between, going back to Lewis's meditation in a tool shed, the difference between looking at the beam and looking along the beam. When we receive the myth experientially as myth, we are looking along the beam. When we step outside the myth to look at it and we begin to analyze it and we draw lots of little meanings out of it, we are allegorizing now. But allegorizing then is an act of abstraction. Now then, if somebody writes a deliberate allegory, that is also perfectly fine. Lewis himself did it in Pilgrim's Regress. But then it's an allegory, not a myth. And the last thing that I'll say about that is that sometimes Lewis doesn't at least seem to be quite consistent about how he approaches allegory. So when he's talking about Spencer as an allegorist, he seems to be talking about Spencer as a myth maker. And so it's really hard to quite pin down what Lewis means by allegory, depending on which text he's looking in or which text he's writing in and that we're looking in. So I will say that allegory is a mystery when we talk about Lewis, as it is when we talk about Tolkien, who hated allegory and yet wrote a clearly allegorical story in the form of Leif by Niggle. So, the issue of allegory for both of these inklings is a very interesting and difficult one. And there are still some questions for which I don't have answers when it comes to that.
That's okay. Once you've got the answers, you can write the next bit. So, in the last chapter in this section, you use the last title, which is found on Dunnus's bookshelf. So, Is Man a Myth? And you outline some ways that man is not a myth. What are some of these ways a man is not a myth?
The idea, is man a myth, on the most literal level for the Narnian story is, Tumnus lived in a world where men were not allowed. Now, we'll find out in later books that there were men further in the south. But apparently Narnia had been cut off from that completely, and there weren't any men around. There were only old stories. And so the question becomes, is man a myth? And so it's just on the level of, does man exist? Now then, we can do some allegorizing, if you will. We can do some application and ask the question in two ways, or answer the question in two ways. One is, if we ask the question, is man a myth? There is the modern answer that Lewis rejected, which is to say, man is a myth because there is no such thing as humankind. There are only animals, and we're just a sophisticated animal. So one of the things that Lewis talks about, especially in his short piece, The Empty Universe, is the idea that we began by stripping the universe of its meaning and of its spiritual connections. And eventually we started doing that with human beings themselves. So human beings then stopped being creatures with freedom and dignity and started being simply sophisticated animals. And so Lewis rejected the idea that we're just a myth. He believed human beings are more important than that. And he believed reason is not something that could have developed naturally. Reason itself, although it exists with us every day, is a supernatural activity, an activity that doesn't belong to animals. It belongs to angels and people and God. And it's only by making this supernatural and, supernatural and omniscient connection, this idea of an eternal logos, to go back to the Greek philosophers. It's only by understanding that as a reality that reason can have any legitimacy whatsoever. If the human mind isn't a mind, but is merely a brain, then that brain is nothing but a bunch of chemical processes. And how then can we trust the chemical processes randomly involved, apart from the existence of any God? How can we trust those processes to show us anything of truth or reality? But I wanted to take it in another direction as well, and it is the idea of saying that man is not a myth, and that's our problem. And I think Lewis would bear this out. We're not mythic enough. We are broken creatures. We are not the human beings we were meant to be. So you recall at the end of Perelandra, when Ransom meets the Adam and the Eve, Tor and Tenedril of Perelandra, and they have achieved the fullness of their glory. Ransom, the human, bows before them and calls them mother and father, and he says, I have never met a real human before. And then that is true of us. None of us has ever met a real human before because we're all broken, we're all fallen. And yet, as Lewis reminds us in The Weight of Glory, there's no such thing as a normal human. Human beings are eternal. We are capable of working our way, making our way eternally toward damnation or eternally toward the glory of God. And every day we're choosing one direction or the other. So we've never met a normal person in that sense either. So there's that moment when Aslan, referring to, I think, Caspian or one of the other human characters, says he's a son of Adam, and that is enough to bow the highest king's head and raise the lowest beggar's head. That's a butchery of the quote, but it's something like that. So we are incredibly valuable, but we were meant to be so much more valuable, is the idea. There's this very peculiar verse in John chapter 10, where Christ, who is actually quoting from the Psalm, says, you are meant to be gods. And there's a Lewis poem that I'm forgetting the name of right now that has this incredibly daunting final line. It's a poem written to God that says, gods you are, you have told us, and we suffer for it, or we pay for it, but something like that. God intended all along for us to be little g gods, if you will, to be mythic creatures, to be like the great heroes of old, the great heroes in stories and the stories that we continue to tell. If we stopped believing in myth, we simply start inventing myth in the form of Luke Skywalker or Captain America, because we need these heroes who are larger than ourselves to remind us that that is our end game, that that is our end goal, to try to become mythic creatures, creatures that could have stories written about them. And if you will, then man is not a myth, and that's our problem. The problem that we very much need to solve, that Aslan, if you will, needs to solve for us.
Excellent, excellent points. Now, we must move on, and let's have you address what you talk about in Chapter 9, or rather, you talk about several books and essays in Chapter 9, is what I'm meaning to say here. Tell the listener some of what they are and how they help with understanding myth, especially, as I believe I'm quoting you here, a way of glimpsing glory of discovering God.
Right. Well, some of the essays that are worth looking at, one that I've already mentioned for sure, is that in addition to dealing with mythology, Lewis also deals with the problem of demythologizing. So I personally believe, for example, that there was a time in Western culture when, with the rise of materialistic science, we set aside our myths but felt this incredible void, and so simply started filling them with scientific myths in the form of science fiction. So we used to talk about angels, and then we simply started talking about UFOs. All right, and we turned Ezekiel's chariot into a UFO in books like Chariots of the Gods and things like that that were very popular in the 70s. There's a really great example of this in 20th century fiction in the form of a book by Michael Crichton called Eaters of the Dead, which was then made into a movie with Antonio Banderas called The 13th Warrior, is essentially a remythologizing of the story of Beowulf. What Crichton did was he took all that science was saying about prehistoric man, if you will, or prehistoric Norsemen before they were writers, and applied that then to the story of Beowulf to make a sort of realistic version of that story. The dragon gets eliminated, but a bunch of horsemen on horses that look like a fire dragon off in the distance replace them. So all these mythic things get replaced with so-called realistic elements. But in the end, Crichton is simply substituting a materialistic myth, which is what science fiction does when it leaves God out of the equation or the supernatural out of the equation, substitutes the one myth for the original. Well, then Lewis very much talks about that in The Empty Universe, the problem of demythologizing. And in the particular chapter, William, as you're asking me to mention various books, I did mention B.F. Skinner's book, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, which again was a specific response to Lewis, to something Lewis said in The Abolition of Man about human freedom and dignity. And Skinner was one of the ones who wanted to say, man is a myth in the worst sense of the word. Man is just an animal whose behavior needs to be controlled. Fortunately, psychology has sort of moved beyond pure behaviorism. And now there's this thing called cognitive psychology that acknowledges that there's something more going on in the brain than we can understand with simple physical reactions. And one of the strong arguments against pure behavioristic psychology, for example, comes from English, of all things, or watching grammar develop in young kids. So if a child says, I'm going to get something, and then he comes back and he said, I goad to get it. That child was never taught the word goad, but what that child did was he took an irregular verb and applied the rules for regular verbs to it. Well, that's a pure indication, a clear indication that there's something cognitive going on inside that kid, that he's actually capable of thought, not just response. So farewell to B.F. Skinner. The other thing that I talk about in that chapter then is the idea of myth and glory, and how myth then can lead us to discovering glory. Myth is a way of glimpsing glory, and glory is incredibly important to us because it's the thing we're after. When Lewis talks about Sehnsucht, when he talks about longing, and he calls it joy in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, I think he tells us very clearly what he's writing about in The Weight of Glory. What we desire is the glory of God in us. And so anything that can give us glimpses of the existence of that glory, which we glimpse through beauty, whether that's beauty in nature or beauty in something that someone has created in the form of music or a story in literature, when we perceive that, we get a hunger for it. We get a hunger for the glory, and we go searching for the source of that glory. We go searching for the thing that can fulfill it. So Lewis talks about glory in places like The Weight of Glory. He talks about it in The Great Divorce with the story of the painter who was told, the reason you were such a successful painter on earth is because when you painted on earth, you captured glimpses of the heavenly landscape. And in my mind, this is what art ought to be for, all art forms, to capture glimpses of the glory that fill people with longing. All right. And I think that's what great art does. I think the reason people still read Shakespeare isn't merely because English teachers force it upon their students, but those students, after it has been forced upon them, find value in him. All right. What makes a great writer versus a writer who can get published? The great writer, we continue to read that writer because somehow that writer has glimpsed a beauty so intense. It might even be a terrible beauty in the form of a tragedy. All right, as Yeats talks about in the idea of a terrible beauty being born. But they're able to glimpse that, and that is something that is so universal and timeless that it continues. And so we still read Homer today. We still read Shakespeare today. And who knows how much longer we're going to continue to read C.S. Lewis. I hope for a very long time to come. Lewis would say, don't put me on a level with Homer or Shakespeare, and that's fair. But Lewis certainly has moments where he also glimpses beauty for us. Something else that myth does that I talk about in the chapter is it lifts the veil of the familiar. All right. And this is something Lewis talks about and an idea that he picked up. I want to say he picked it up from G.K. Chesterton, but it might have been from George MacDonald. But I live in a beautiful part of West Virginia, only an hour south from where William lives. His part is real pretty, but mine's prettier. But I have deer in my yard almost on a daily basis. And of late, I've been trying to make friends with a groundhog who I see wandering about our campus. And we get chipmunks and squirrels, of course. Squirrels are ubiquitous. But it would be real easy in seeing deer in your yard every day to become numb to that beauty, simply because we get used to it, right? So it might be a beautiful sunset. It might be beautiful architecture. It might be, a beautiful countryside. But if we see it all the time, it might lose some of its charm. And so there's this veil of familiarity. And the veil is a veil over wonder, over our sense of awe. And then Lewis says, one of the things that's awesome about myth is that it lifts the veil of the familiar. And so myth, for example, will help me remember that, the myth of an enchanted wood will help me remember that the wood right here around my house with the squirrels and the chipmunks and the deer is also a little bit enchanted. And that's something that Lewis talks about in talking about myth. So among the books then that I, the Lewis texts that I talk about in that chapter, in chapter 9, include then The Great Divorce, The Pilgrim's Regress, and here I would urge the listener to go to the afterword in Pilgrim's Regress and look at Lewis's different definitions of romanticism, and then finally, especially his final definition, which shows us so much about the nature of glory. Then in Surprised by Joy, in Mere Christianity and Miracles. And I love that wonderful line in Mere Christianity where he says, desires are meant to be fulfilled. A duck desires to swim. Boom, there's water. He can go swimming. All right. Now, a person may desire to eat. That doesn't guarantee the person's going to eat, but it does guarantee that food exists somewhere in the world. And that fulfillment might be possible somewhere in the world. All right, I might be able to find some food. But if I find in myself a desire which nothing else in this world can satisfy, it suggests at least the possibility that I was meant to have that desire satisfied somewhere else, that I was meant for another world, is the way Lewis says it. And maybe then that thing that I desire is to be found in that other world. And that's why glory is so incredibly important to Lewis, because that's the thing that we're going after. That's the thing we most desperately want. And again, I would really encourage the reader to read, or the listener to read, The Weight of Glory. We were meant to be gods, and that's that promise. We were meant for a transformation. We were meant to be little versions of Jesus. That's what the word Christian means. Lewis makes that a central point in Mere Christianity, that our goal as followers of Christ is to become little versions of him. That's what we're after. That's what we're pursuing all the time.
Ah, very fascinating, Charlie. Thank you for sharing that. When you were mentioning about how when you're familiar with something, then it becomes, you notice it less or you appreciate it less. I couldn't help but thinking that I realized after I used to live in a different area, and that I was recently here now traveling through that area by the nature of my type of work that I do. Anyway, and I remember that they had a stump in front of the yard. This was in front of a house, and that the person who apparently lived there was very good, or they hired someone to transform that stump into an eagle. And so they were able to carve that. And so it took more than a few days. So over several weeks, I noticed it slowly transforming, and it was just, you know, marvelous. And then, you know, months would go by, and you know, it's been, you know, it had been done for, you know, quite a long time by then. And so I was like, oh, you know, okay, yeah, there it is. But now I haven't been in that area for a couple years, and apparently they have a new owner, and I don't know if the old owner took it with them, but it's not there anymore. So it was disappointing, but then also I got so used to it, it was nothing fabulous. But it's so true that you get familiar with something that at one point was so amazing. And so it's interesting how that happens, and then how we can, you know, as you were just sharing about the antidote to that, essentially.
Yeah. Now, Sarah, you live in a place where the buildings are older than the country that William and I live in. Do you ever get to, does the veil of familiarity ever drop over the buildings of Oxford and the UK?
Not so often, but I've only lived here for 5 years, so I think that helps. But no, definitely, I think it's one of those things where if you're commuting to work or something, you don't really take it in. But when you stop and show someone else around the city, you then are re-enlivened to its beauty again, I think.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're going to need to wrap up. So this is concluding the fifth part of a six-part mini-series on the Fawn's Bookshelf by Charlie Starr. We just finished discussing the third part of his book, which again was entitled, that section is called Terran Reality as Myth in Narnia. And those were chapters 7-9. But before we go, let me have you this time around. Let's have Charlie tell a little bit about himself.
All right. Well, I've been a high school teacher in the past and a college professor for pushing 30 years now, getting closer to it. And I currently teach at Alderson Broaddus University in a little town called Philippi, West Virginia. And here I teach English composition, and I teach some literature classes. I also teach some humanities classes. So this coming semester, for example, I'll be teaching an introduction to humanities, and I guarantee I talk about beauty and glory and the importance of the arts for transcendent meaning and personal health in that class. So that's some of what I do. And then, of course, I spend a lot of time reading the works of C.S. Lewis, or reading about C.S. Lewis, and writing about Lewis. Recently, I was pleased to be able to visit the Marion E. Wade Center at Wheaton College near Chicago. And there I worked on looking at original Lewis manuscripts and trying to date those manuscripts by changes in Lewis's handwriting, which occurred throughout his lifetime. And I was able to do some dating there. And then I also got to look inside Lewis's personal library. And Lewis would often write notes, sometimes extensive notes, in his own copies of books. And sometimes those notes just reveal absolute gems. Even most recently, right at the end of my visit to the Wade Center, I found what I think was is an unknown poem written inside the hardcover of one of Lewis's books. So I think he wrote a poem that nobody else had had seen yet, and that's very exciting because the poem's very very interesting. So I love to work with Lewis documents, with his handwriting, with manuscripts. I've written two books on Lewis and hope to have a third out in the next year or two. I've done some writing on popular culture. I'm a big fan of film and television. I have a lovely wife of 36 years, two grown children who are awesome kids, and a granddaughter who I think is pretty cool too.
All right. Thank you for that, Charlie. And we encourage people to check out your other books as well as the one that we've been focusing on. And speaking of that book, then, that we've been talking about this time, we'll do it again next time for the final section in your book, Beyond the Bookshelf, three more chapters covering your chapters 10, 11, and 12. Well, before we go then, Charlie, thanks for joining Sarah and I on today's podcast.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And finally, thank you, Sarah, for being here to co-host.
Thank you for having me.
Also, let me thank you, the listener, for your interest in this episode of All About Jack. All About Jack is a feature of the website, EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm the creator of the show, William O'Flaherty. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com, where you will find a variety of content, including, of course, previous episodes of All About Jack. But the most popular part of the site is a series of articles about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. I also have a YouTube channel called Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to it. Today you heard the next to last episode in a mini-series about the Fonz Bookshelf. There are six shows in all. The one you just heard was about the third part of Charlie's book. Next time you'll hear Charlie talk about the final part of his book in greater detail, and then a quick review of some of the first two parts that were covered more thoroughly in the second and third episode of this mini-series. You'll find links in the show notes to purchase the book, along with links to the previous shows and other places that were mentioned during the show. Plus, there's a link to help you locate other episodes when Charlie was a guest before this mini-series. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis, Most are not by him. Some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.